Welcome to this episode of Bioethics for the People, the most popular bioethics podcast on the planet, according to Grandma Nancy. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Devin Stahl, who dutifully completes the same five New York Times puzzles every single day.
And I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Tyler Gibb, who, if he weren't here right now, would probably be golfing. All right. Good morning, Tyler. I have a question for you.
Okay, great.
What is the definition of futility?
Ooh, futility. Well, as you may have read, futility is defined in a lot of different ways, especially in healthcare. So the way that I think about futility is it's actually based upon one of our former professors. Do you remember Dr. Trotter, Griff?
I do remember Griff, and I use his definition a lot.
Do you? Do you use the same one that I do?
I do.
So it's a goal, a reasonable action intended to achieve that goal, and then virtual certainty that the action will not achieve the goal it's intended.
Okay.
Is that right?
That's very... A+, you passed your comprehensive exam on Bioethics for the People. I always think of a kid with a bucket who's trying to fill it up, but there's a bunch of holes in it. And he'll never be able to fill up that bucket. So sort of a metaphor. But in healthcare, we do talk a lot about, well, we used to talk a lot about futility. And then people started to say, I don't know, the way we're not defining futility very well. And is that what we really mean? And it leads to a lot of controversies, especially when patients ask for things that doctors think might be futile care.
Yeah.
So we have a special guest today who's going to walk us through maybe not even futility, but something related to what do we do when patients or their families ask us for treatments that we think might not work or might not help a patient. So, Peter, will you introduce yourself?
Absolutely. The first thing that I want to do is thank you, Dr. Stahl, Dr. Gibb, for inviting me here. I so appreciate the work that you do for bioethics and for making this podcast available widely. We are all in your debt, for sure. I'm Dr. Peter DiPergola. I am the Chief Ethics Officer and Senior Director of Clinical and Organizational Ethics for Bay State Health in Western Massachusetts, which is comprised of five hospitals and about 100 outpatient facilities. It's our academic medical center that's in partnership with University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School. I also have the privilege of serving as the Shaunis Family Chair for the Study of the Humanities and Associate Professor of Bioethics and Medical Humanities at Elms College, which is also located in Western Massachusetts.
A lot of fancy titles. I'm glad we asked you to do that yourself. I think I would have messed it up.
Elm College, I know nothing about Elm College, but I imagine it's beautiful.
It is. The formal name is the College of Our Lady of the Elms. So it's shortened down to Elms College, and it truly is beautiful, sort of the crown jewel of West Massachusetts.
All right. And so in your work in clinical ethics, and it sounds like you have kind of a broad portfolio of things that you are working on or interested in or have responsibility for. So we're looking specifically today about clinical ethics and your experience working with what I call non-beneficial treatment policies or futility policies, or maybe there's an even better name for it. So,
yeah, thank you so much again for the opportunity. One of the things that I saw, so in my health system, we receive anywhere between 1,600 and 2,000 consults, clinical ethics consults per year.
What? Oh, I got to pause. Oh my gosh. Wait a second. That is.
Yes.
That, so many.
I've never heard of that many. Holy moly.
Yes.
How many ethicists do you have working on that kind of volume?
We have an entire party of one.
Oh, my goodness.
What?
So,
yes. I don't know who's in charge of your job, but they need to address that. That seems unsustainable. I mean, maybe your lived experience echoes kind of the look on Devin and I's face when you said 2,000 consults. But go on. Tell us more.
Yes. So
you're a saint and definitely overworked. Yeah. So the audience needs to know that.
Thank you. It's an honor to do the work. And I work for a great place, and I have wonderful, very dedicated sort of advocates who support me along the way. Of those, 1,600 to 2,000 consults a year, about 77% are end of life related. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of those come from the Department of Medicine. 54% of that 77% come from our critical care units. The most common consult that we receive is requests by surrogate decision makers of incapacitated patients for what I've now come to describe as clinically ineffective, inconsequential, or disproportionately harmful interventions. So what we used to call futile interventions or non-beneficial interventions, or even non-beneficial treatments. I have been spending a lot of time trying to think about the appropriate language that we use when describing this so that we can communicate in a compassionate, effective way with families so that they can know that they have done everything they can for the people they love most. And it also provides our providers with a clear way of thinking about what would make an appropriate justification for not initiating, continuing, or escalating a life-sustaining treatment that doesn't veer into the independent, subjective, non-clinical realm that we often see in sort of subjective quality of life judgments, something that we can't prove either way. And so we are trying and continue to try. We're revising this policy. It's become a little bit of my white whale, so to speak. I hope I have a different fate than Captain Ahab. But it's really become a passion project for me so that I can both support our patients in their families, in their grieving process, but also my providers and making sure that they know they're on the straight and narrow mm-hmm. when they're making those determinations.
Yeah, it's such an important work. And I think that most clinical ethicists deal with end of life futility, non-beneficial treatment, ineffective treatment, as kind of bread and butter of what they do, right? It's a major part of most clinical ethics practices. So maybe before we get into the language that you've changed and that you found useful, maybe we can talk about some of the language that's not great that we hear, and you can tell us why it's not great.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So the one that I hear all the time that drives me crazy is futile care. So what are your problems with futile care as a terminology?
Yeah, it's great. Futility, from the Latin futilis, which means worthless, is, I think, sort of intrinsically subjective, too much of a medical jargon term that you would never hear from your mechanic or your dentist to say, we're not going to do this. We're not going to remove the engine and put in something new because it's futile. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's very unique to healthcare. We don't hear it outside of that. I would never say to my wife after an argument, for example, continuing this is futile, right?
Yeah, it feels like it cuts off all conversation, right? That it's like, I have made this determination and you can't object to it, and this is futile and this is my determination.
Exactly.
But can we interject that, resistance is futile is a great Star Trek phrase that ought not to be. Maybe we're of a certain age, maybe I'm of a certain age, but come on, that's what I think of first.
Absolutely. I think there's space to carve that out, to retain certain uses. That would be appropriate.
Yeah, certain anachronistic pop culture references. What about the word care? Often what it just doesn't seem right. It doesn't set right with me when we're talking about something being futile or inappropriate. Care is the word care a problem?
The word care is absolutely a problem there. Care, like love, could never be futile, could never be worthless. And even the word treatment, I dislike the use of the word futile treatment. Treatment itself is not value neutral. If there is a treatment, it means that you have something for which I can intervene and leave you better, or at least no worse than I found you. I'm actively participating in remedying this problem that you have. What I prefer is a more value neutral intervention. So all treatments are interventions, but not all interventions are treatments.
That's a good distinction. And the classic, I'm always going to get this wrong because I'm not an MD. People will, when you're trying to make analogies sometimes with this, these kinds of requests, it'll be like, well, if a patient came and said that they wanted antibiotics for a viral infection, which they do because people don't totally understand how antibiotics work, no doctor would say yes because antibiotics don't treat a viral infection. And actually, taking too many antibiotics can hurt you. And actually can hurt everybody. That's a whole maybe different conversation. But we would never do that. So, you know, there might be kinds of treatments or interventions that people request that really just can't effectuate the thing that we want them to. And you would be right to say no. So is antibiotics for a viral infection futile intervention?
It's almost as if you're reading the policy that I'm revising. So I use that as a primary example of, and, you know, I have identified three terms that I think are the most thorough and the most useful in this context. And those are, in order, ineffective, inconsequential, and then disproportionately harmful. And the ineffective and the disproportionately harmful are the two extremes. And then some inconsequential interventions, we can get into sort of how that becomes a little bit gray. But as far as ineffective interventions, those are the clearest examples of things that we can say, even if I wanted to provide something to meet the patient or the family's requests, to meet their needs, to meet them where they are, I would have to, in order to provide an ineffective intervention that I knew, I wasn't trialing it to try to find out if it was ineffective or not. I knew in advance that it wasn't. For example, antibiotics for the flu. It's something that cannot, either by design in this case or by effect, fulfill the purpose for which it's applied. In that way, it has no possibility now or ever in the future of achieving the purpose for which it is prescribed. And so antibiotics for the flu, no matter how many you prescribe, it's simply not what it does.
I think the literature used to call this physiologic futility. Is that right? Where it's physiologically, biochemically, you know, whatever the science is, it's not going to do the thing that you think it would. And this is different, I think we should note, than treatments that we're kind of uncertain about or ambiguous about, right?
Exactly right. Yes. So I would never call, you know, ineffective, inconsequential, or disproportionately harmful those interventions that there are reasons to believe there's some sort of empirical evidence to suggest that it could potentially work. I think those are absolutely justified in terms of exploring those things, especially when we want to turn over every stone to make sure that we are doing everything we can for the patient. So the antibiotics are a perfect example of an ineffective intervention by design. An ineffective intervention by effect would be something that was working. So let's say artificial nutrition and hydration provided through a G-tube, it has been working until now. And now we see that the patient's body is no longer assimilating the nutrition and hydration. The body's becoming fluid overloaded. It's now ineffective by effect. Something that was once effective is no longer effective by the circumstances, but not by design.
Yeah. And I think so. Maybe another example that I have used a lot when I'm trying to describe this is if somebody has a condition called DIC, diffuse intervascular, whatever it is, coagulopathy, basically they're not clotting their blood, right? They've got some sort of usually a liver disease or injury where they're just not clotting and they're just like bleeding out, right? And so adding more and more and more blood products to somebody who is unable to assimilate and use those is an example, I think, of like ineffective by effect, is as you described. Yes. Is that?
Yes, that's precisely right. And so I think when we communicate with patients and families about ineffective interventions, those are our best, strongest clinical case, because we know in advance we have, I won't get into the weeds about the distinctions between empirical proof and empirical evidence. There are many things that we can't prove, or simply because we can't disprove that something's going to happen. I imagine both of you have had your fair share of conversations with patients and families who are waiting for a miracle. It's not something we can disprove. That doesn't mean the burden of proof is on me to disprove it. The burden of proof would be on the person making the claim. But in this case, even if we don't have perfect proof. We have very solid empirical evidence that by design or effect, these interventions would never have any possibility of achieving the purpose for which they were applied.
And so that seems like a pretty narrow category, right? It's a pretty small group of things that patients or families might request of physicians that we would, I think very reasonable person, everyone, most reasonable people would say, that's not something that a good doctor should do. And if I'm a good doctor, I'm not going to do those things or provide those things.
Exactly. You know, if we think about it in sort of syllogistic logic, in order to provide a clinical intervention, I need a clinical reason to justify it. I don't have a clinical reason to justify it. Therefore, I don't have a clinical obligation to provide it, because in order to provide something for which I don't have a justification, I'd need to come up with an independent, subjective, non-clinical reason to justify it. That's outside the scope of practice.
Yeah, I like the way that you frame that. And so that's the narrow category, maybe the smaller category of ineffective treatment. And then the next category you described was inconsequential.
Yes. So inconsequential interventions are interventions as we define it that are effective. They are technically effective and they're not disproportionately harmful. And we'll get to that other sort of extreme in a moment. But they won't change the outcome or the relative timing of the outcome.
Okay.
So this, a good example of this would be continuing antibiotics. Let's say you had a crystal ball and you knew in advance that, you know, the patient was rapidly progressing toward brain death. Yes, they were also suffering from an infection. The family will agree to DNR, DNI on the condition that antibiotics continue. For whatever reason, they're very fixated on the antibiotics. The clinical team wants to transition to a comfort measures only or a comfort-oriented approach, typically doesn't include antibiotics, but the antibiotics are working. They are doing something, and the patient's tolerating it just fine. And so, but they're not going to change the outcome for the patient, or in this very sort of specific example that I gave, the timing of the outcome. It wouldn't turn anything around in the same outcome, would happen in the same sort of time frame. So I would say where there is wiggle room in those three distinctions, that would be the gray zone, that inconsequential interventions can often be justified. And not that we would ever use interventions in any way as a helpful negotiating tool, but sometimes it does provide comfort to family members of patients who need to know that they're doing something. You know, transitioning completely to comfort measures only doesn't feel right for them. And so they want to get 99% of the way there, but please continue the antibiotics. You know, the antibiotics are working, patients tolerating it just fine. That's acceptable because there's still a clinical reason to continue to provide them. However, the scarcer the resource, the higher the bar of justification. So if we're talking about repeated blood transfusions in the last 6 hours of life, that's obviously a more difficult thing to justify than the continued antibiotics. And so our litmus test is how scarce is this particular resource when it is really scarce. We need additional reasons to justify things that the patient would, for example, with those repeated blood transfusions, it would make a biocellular difference for the patient. Patient would tolerate it just fine, but because it's not going to change the outcome, it's much more difficult to justify than the readily available antibiotics.
Yeah, I can see how that can, I mean, obviously that's something, scarcity is something that we've dealt with for the last several years, even before the pandemic, but obviously during the pandemic as well. Are there limitations on things that can be like interventions or treatment plans that can be determined to be inconsequential? So you mentioned blood products, maybe antibiotics. What about like ventilators or like beds in the ICU? Can those also fall in that same category?
Yeah, I would say that we typically wouldn't look at it if we... The point of these making these distinctions is really to help us stay as close as possible to the clinical science of what's going on, because there's always a human tendency to say, you know, I don't think we should continue because I worry about what sort of quality of life the patient would have. I think quality of life judgments are a critical part of healthcare ethics, of healthcare delivery, but they're not something that we can demonstrate empirically. I really think that we should rely on the expertise of the patient or the family to tell us the sort of life the patient would want to live. We can raise questions about it, but we can't disprove it. Mm-hmm. And so what inconsequential interventions tries to identify are not things like whether or not, you know, we should make available additional beds, but rather to focus on whether the intervention being provided right now does confer a net clinical benefit to the patient, will affect in some way, shape, or form the outcome or the timing of the outcome, and whether or not there's we can bring out of the harm caused an equal or greater clinical good for the patient. If we can say yes to those things, then I think it would be a very tall order to make any sort of distinctions, because then about pulling back a bed or a ventilator, because now we're getting into that subjective realm that I'm desperately trying to help us avoid.
Right.
So maybe I'm misunderstanding, Peter, and you can help me. It feels like this category of inconsequential, I understand the kind of scenario you've given us, but it just seems like if we're going to talk about the outcome or the timing of the outcome, we have to be pretty clear in the prognosis. And physicians are actually pretty bad at prognosticating. Studies show that they tend to underestimate longevity kind of like at the end of life for a lot of, especially ICU physicians. So some of this, you know, if it's about, especially if it's about timing, you might say, okay, this particular intervention, this patient, we are almost certain is going to die in the hospital. They're not going to be discharged alive. And so it's not going to change the outcome of that. But when you start getting into, well, maybe this will give them another day or two or week or not, that seems to get really squishy and difficult. I mean, I can hardly get our physicians to prognosticate like months, much less in the like sort of smaller time frame. So how do you think about just how accurate or how good they have to feel about the prognosis in order to fall into this category?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I would say that this category primarily exists to help providers with that sort of acute scarcity issue rather than the antibiotic issue. Mm-hmm. I think unless you have a very clear idea, right, the patient is actively dying in front of you, you're witnessing the signs, mm-hmm. right? You're doing the brain death, yeah. Repeat brain death exams. In absence of that, I think not being able to know if it's know exactly if it's going to affect the outcome or the timing of the outcome is a reason to stay away from trying to withdraw interventions when you don't have a strong justification for yeah. that.
So it is really tied to a good faith prognostication about longevity of the patient's life, which makes this Absolutely. Category also seem really quite narrow as well.
Absolutely. It is extremely narrow. And again, because nobody, clinical precision certainly has its limits too. We would have to be very, very certain. But what I am hoping is that our providers can feel comfortable living in that inconsequential realm to say, even if I think antibiotics that are treating this infection, the result of which is really not what's actively causing the patient's death, I can justify continuing to provide it because it is effective. It's not really harmful and it's not scarce. It doesn't fulfill that criteria.
It's good also to give physicians something to hold on to because withdrawing in these other scenarios tends to be more, in this last scenario you're about to name, is a little bit more difficult if you're getting pressure from typically the patient's right. family not to withdraw. In my experience, the hedging tends to go the other way. Like, providers don't necessarily want to withdraw over family objections. They have to have a really strong reason to do that. Every now and again, there will be a provider who is trying to withdraw things that a family really wants to continue, and then we have to have that conversation. But at least in my experience, it happens more often the other way, where the provider's saying, like, I just don't think that this is doing anything, but I don't know if we're allowed to say no. Are we ever allowed to say no? That's more of the consults I get. I don't know about you two. What do you think, Tyler? Is that more common?
I think so. And folks who are maybe not in conflict, but there's disagreement amongst the team. And, you know, one physician is very adamant about one position and maybe the nursing staff or the social worker staff or another physician team is disagreeing about maybe a prognosis, but also the appropriateness.
Yeah, no, that's my experience as well. Something that sort of keeps me up at night, certainly not unique to my health system, I think this is true everywhere, is that you can have two providers within the same unit who have completely different approaches to precisely the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that can really complicate and compound the grief of families who need to know that they did everything for the person they love most and who might feel like the only way to know that they fulfilled that is to scream louder, to threaten more, to threaten mm-hmm. to sue, to fire this physician, to find someone else who might be willing. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't be surprised at any of our institutions that if we took two providers from, you know, a critical care unit and we asked, you know, the family wants X, we don't think that there's a clinical justification for it. What do you think? You know, provider A may say, you know, without a clinical reason, I'm absolutely not providing this. You know, it's outside of my scope. I don't get to just arbitrarily decide what interventions are applied. And provider B would say, who am I to judge, right? Mm-hmm. If this is really important to the family, those sort of things keep me up that night as an ethicist, because how end of life goes, as both of you know, as well as I do, you know, patients experience their dying, but it's their family who experiences their death. And all of the narrative identity that comes with that, you know, was I a good daughter, good son? How do I know? Mm-hmm. I know because I did everything. And how do I know that I did that? Well, I asked for more, pushed harder, mm-hmm. and so on.
Yeah. I oftentimes in these cases where it's a family who's insistent and sometimes rightfully insistent in the face of healthcare decision making, they sometimes we try to reframe it as saying, like, you know, the way in which you love your family member changes towards the end of your life, and you have to love them in a different way. And and sometimes that can be helpful, but so many families have such a hard time, understandably, dealing with loss, particularly sudden, unexpected loss, and what their emotional state is in that moment when they're dealing with all these, you know, family and relationship and emotional disruption. But then we're asking them to make these really complicated, like life and death, literally, decisions in the clinical setting. Just seems sometimes that they're just not set up to succeed, or like the cards are stacked against them to be able to execute, discharge that responsibility that they have for their loved one in a way that is compassionate and caring and loving.
Absolutely. I think we spend our lives feeling like being loving means doing more. And then we learn at the end of life that being loving usually looks like doing less, mm-hmm. not in terms of loving less, but adding one more intervention can be unloving, not because of intention, but because of effect. Mm-hmm. And that is a very difficult lesson to learn when you're grieving, when you've not thought long and hard about the values at stake and making decisions for your loved one, you know, with whom you've never communicated about what they would have wanted. It's end of life decision-making creates a real existential crisis for everybody involved, mm-hmm. providers included.
And so we've got two narrow categories or two small categories. So ineffective treatment, and there's two flavors of that, and then not inconsequential treatment. And then the last one is like what I would refer to as like our catch-all bucket of everything else. Is that accurate?
Yes, I would say the disproportionately harmful treatment. And I think that there is, to sort of begin, I do think that there are proportionately harmful interventions that are regularly justified. So if I need a splenectomy, how do we justify cutting through my otherwise healthy tissue to get to my diseased organ to take it out? Well, mm-hmm. we justify the harm caused in otherwise healthy good tissue because we can bring out of that harm an equal or greater net clinical good for me. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's why we tolerate side effects for blood pressure medications or antibiotics, whatever it is. So proportionate harm is very much a part, unavoidable part of healthcare delivery. What makes disproportionately harmful interventions, and here you can imagine a family's request for CPR and intubation to be initiated on their centenarian grandmother with metastatic bone cancer, who we know upon cardiac arrest will not only fracture ribs and not only not be able to reverse the issue, but we would add to one terrible event just another set of terrible details. So to me, that's not harm caused in sort of a proportionate way where we can bring out of the harm caused an equal or greater clinical good for the patient. That's often the bucket that we fall in at the end of life. What I would say is, again, if we don't know if it would be disproportionately harmful, I don't think if we're uncertain, that's not enough of a reason not to proceed in that form of unknowing. But when we have good empirical evidence that the intervention itself would be worse than the disease, not in a subjective sense where we're trying to say, I couldn't imagine tolerating that, or I couldn't imagine my mom tolerating that, but is this something the patient is willing to tolerate? Instead, will the intervention now cause harm out of which I can't bring an equal or greater good? So we define the disproportionately harmful interventions just that way. It's an intervention that, you know, by design or by effect causes gross and unjustified harm out of which the patient cannot derive an equal or greater net personal clinical good.
This one seems, the example you have given seems like a really justifiable one. I can imagine there are some things that get a little harder at the edges. So I wonder if the policy you're developing, often these policies will require two physicians to agree, maybe somebody on the patient's care and somebody not on the patient's team, just to give an outside view. And certainty is an interesting word. I mean, as you noted earlier, there's not a ton of certainty. Maybe you said proof, but I've heard people talk about this as moral certainty rather than some other kind of certainty. Like my very best guess with all the knowledge that I have is this, and I feel so certain about it, I would like put moral stake in that. But of course, miracles happen, things happen outside of my control. I can't be in some ways certain about anything, but that's not the bar. Like, you know, I'm 100% certain that there's no way I could possibly ever be wrong about this. That would be a kind of ridiculous sort of certainty, but there are other kinds of certainty, and maybe I've made it too complicated.
No, not at all. I think, you know, what we're aiming for is, you know, rational, justified belief is probably as close as we get. The same sort of rational, justified belief that when we provide X antibiotic or prescribe X antibiotic to treat Y bacterial infection, that we have reasons to believe that it will be effective in this case. And we know that from past experience, similar cases that we can do that, that we can draw that conclusion from. And no, it's not perfect. I actually don't know with 100% certainty if it will work, but there are good reasons to believe. And it's not just a matter of personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Is this the biggest bucket? Sorry, I know we were using a bucket metaphor earlier. Is that, you think this is the one that's both potentially most contentious, or the most things might fall into it as a clinical ethicist?
I would say, you know, certainly in my experience, I would say the first and the third buckets are the most regularly employed. And you'll see some bleed over into when I'm not sure if something is disproportionately harmful, the way that it's described to me in a clinical sense, I'll try to push for a more narrow interpretation of if it's possible that we can demonstrate that it would be ineffective, that would be the clearest. So ineffective by design or ineffective by effect. There are some interventions that we don't know if they will be effective. Because we don't know if they'll be effective, we don't know if they'll be consequential, because if they are effective, then they probably will be consequential, and vice versa. But we're almost sure that it will cause harm out of which we can't bring an equal or greater good. And in those cases, we really want to wait, if at all possible, to see if things can become clearer as time goes on, right? The condition changes such that now it's more readily evident that this would be disproportionately harmful, or now it's tipped over into an ineffectiveness. So we would love, if it's at all possible, for at least two of those distinctions to be true at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of a case in which your policy or your framework was particularly useful or beneficial or provided clarity where clarity didn't exist before?
Yeah, so one of the most pertinent cases that I have faced, and we serve a generally health underliterate, often illiterate population, and so we're sort of a safety net health system, serve a lot of underserved patients and families who come from historical backgrounds that are rightly suspicious of healthcare and wondering if they're going to get the same treatment as people who look different from them. And unfortunately, we've given them reason to believe that, not at my institution in particular, but American society has created that reality. And so not only is it sort of difficult to meet every patient and family where they are in general, but especially so when we're doing so through a translator or for a patient whose first language is not English. And so what we try to do in those cases is really make sure that we're understanding the cultural values and expressions and trying to parse out what is myth and what is reality in our clinical practice. In one particular example, we were caring for a woman with an 80 or so year old woman with fragile X syndrome, rare genetic disorder that left her, among other things, with about the cognitive ability of somebody about the age of 10. Not exactly sure how they assessed that, but I would say sort of the permanent intellectual capacity of somebody about the age of 10. So sophisticated intellectual capacity. And she had come in and out of the hospital every other week for the past 6 months or so with recurrent bouts of aspiration pneumonia, was heading into multi-system organ failure. The thing that brought her the most quality of life was sharing an extended care facility room with her twin brother, who also had mm-hmm. Fragile X. They watched Wheel of Fortune on repeat every day together. So her healthcare proxy was her cousin, who was a lawyer. And we started to become worried that that the treatment would soon become worse than the disease. We weren't there yet, and we didn't get into the ineffective or disproportionately harmful buckets, but we did worry that we would get there soon, and soon enough we did get there. The healthcare proxy, who was a disabilities attorney, said, you're only doing this because she has a intellectual disability and you would treat someone else differently. Of course, that's not what we were doing, but those sort of claims tend to stop my provider colleagues in their tracks to say, hold on.
Yeah. They're harsh and they are jarring, and they call into question not just the clinical acumen and skills, but also the integrity of the provider, which I mean is it's like the most it's one of the most like arresting type of accusations that can be lobbied at healthcare providers, I think, that you're treating me differently because of something else.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I always think back to Aquinas in his very wise words that, whatever is received in the mode of the receiver. So you can control your language and delivery, but you can't put another person into receive mode to hear what you're saying. That sort of has to come from an internal willingness to do that. And so how you communicate with different patients and families will always be different. But in this particular case, I was talking to somebody for whom logic was very important, certainly professionally in the legal profession. And he was sort of understandably in denial. His entire life and advocacy for his professional life has been advocating for people like his cousin. And that was a big part of his identity. If I can't advocate in this way, who am I? How do I fulfill my other narrative goals in my life? So as the patient unfortunately deteriorated, he was trying to rest on the logic of, and he said to me directly at one point, isn't it true that you need quantity of life? I'm trying to think of how he phrased it now. It's one of these two ways. So isn't it true that in order to have quality of life, you need to have quantity of life as a precondition? And so we said, you know, that is literally true. So we had started to talk about quality of life and what the patient would have wanted and how what we could offer clinically resonated or did not resonate with her values and the things that she liked most. Not, again, not that that is the primary driver. And we were soon going to get into the ineffective argument. But he said, well, if you're thinking about quality of life, that's only enjoyed by people who are alive. And so let's pursue quantity as aggressively as possible. But what he was not realizing is that in certain cases, particularly in this case, the more aggressively we pursued quantity on one side, the more rapidly we reduced the possibility of quality on the other. Mm-hmm. But these were two inward facing arrows. It wasn't just a proportionate amount that came both ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that inverse relationship, I think, is hard for people to wrap their heads around and really understand as it applies to their loved one in the bed at the time, I think.
Absolutely. And so what ended up being helpful to him, which would be something very different for what would be helpful to a different patient and family, was understanding that in order to provide a clinical intervention, we need a clinical reason to justify it. We don't have a clinical reason to justify it, and therefore we, even if we wanted to, couldn't provide it, right? That would violate our professional standards. That sort of linear logical thinking was particularly helpful to him, and he was appreciative of those fine-grained distinctions that we were making. And so even though he didn't like what we were saying, we still earned his trust. And I think sometimes in clinical ethics consultation, that's the best we do. It's not to get everybody to see the way we do, but to understand that we're looking at the same thing, we're working toward the same goal. If we didn't care about the patient's life, we would do whatever he asked. Mm-hmm. We're only saying no because we do care.
Good. Well, I really like that. I think these distinctions are super helpful. And my guess is that because we have basically everybody important listens to this podcast, it's going to absolutely change policy all around the country, if not the world, because we have a lot of good international listeners as well. So get ready for, should we name it after you, or what would you like us to call this this policy?
That's a great question. I've never thought of myself as important enough to think of a policy named.
Yeah.
Something in particular. I'll put my thinking cap on.
We'll call it the Peter policy for now.
There you go. Yes, yeah. Not the Peter principle, please. Right. That's a different thing.
That's taken care of.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very different thing. Good. Well, thank you for sharing this. I think this will be helpful to a lot of folks.
Appreciate your time, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to meet both of you. I follow both of your work. I look forward to staying in touch.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Bioethics for the People. We can't do it alone. Thanks to Christopher Wright for writing and producing our theme song, Darian Golden-Stahl for designing our logo, and all the artwork you don't see because this is a podcast. If you like us, please rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you love us, visit our website, bioethicsforthepeople.com, to snag some of our merch.